Special number 11902, Lieutenant Commander W.S. Smith, Reel 1.
When was it that you joined the Navy, please, and why?
Well, I'd always... was always keen on joining the Navy, you know, from about the age of 12. And I joined at the age of 15.
Was it easy to get in 1935?
Well, I don't think they were turning many people down in those days. And I went to Manchester to the recruiting centre, as Hull was closed down due to the fact that the chap there was sick at the time. And I passed the various tests I had to do, and 3 months after that, I had the instructions to join HMS Ganges.
What was your training like there, from what you remember of it?
Well, HMS Ganges,
yes,
very strict, but very good training indeed.
In what way was it so strict?
Well, discipline was fairly hard in those days.
Were you punished yourself?
I think I did about 3 days number 11s.
What was that?
Running around the parade ground with a rifle.
And what did you get punished for?
Breaking a window.
Was that hooliganism?
Well, I suppose so. I think most of the punishments there were fair. I don't think you got punished very often unless you deserved it.
So you didn't resent the discipline?
Oh, no.
Did it fit you for what you had to do later in the Navy?
I think it was very good groundwork. Very good training.
What were you doing when war broke out?
When war broke out, I'd just come back from the Far East. I did 2.5 years on HMS Suffolk, county class cruiser, which was based in China, at Hong Kong. In fact, we returned in the May, and I was on leave when war broke out.
What did you feel when you heard the war declaration? Were you dismayed about it?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I don't suppose anybody wanted a war, but I mean, when you're in the Navy and you join on your own free will, and it's what you want to do in any case, if a war comes, it comes. And then it's a little bit different to the ones we've had lately. I mean, you were fighting for your country then.
Now, during the Dunkirk crisis, I think you had some rather interesting special duties. Can you tell me what they were?
Well, I was sentry at HMS Collingwood. In fact, I liked HMS Collingwood. I was running for the Portsmouth Command. It wasn't quite a good place for going ashore. But I'd passed for leading seaman. And suddenly, instead of before the war, you'd pass for leading seaman or petty officer, and you'd wait 2.5 years from the date of passing before you got promoted. But then when the war came, promotion was rapid. I mean, people were getting made within 6 months, and it even got less than that. So I thought I'd better volunteer for sea and get some practical experience in, as coxswain of the sea boat and leading hand of the forecastle and various seamanship duties. And Captain of Collingwood, I don't think he took very kindly to it. He thought I didn't like his establishment. Anyhow, the next thing, I had a draft within a fortnight of putting in, and I suddenly was sent down to our own barracks in Portsmouth and reported to the regulating office. And the RPO said, you're going to SS Holland. SS Holland, it's a merchant ship. I didn't know much about merchant navy, sea boats and anchors and cables, etc. So I wasn't very pleased about that. I started to complain Well, you didn't get much joy in those days. He said, get your bagnamic in the truck at 5 o'clock or lift your lid. Which lift your lid means you're in the rattle. So I went to this ship, which was in Portsmouth Dockyard.
This was in June, was it?
This was in June, yes. And the first thing I saw was damn great crane with a big bucket, and they were tipping cement into this ship. And that was the one I was going to, which turned out to be a block ship. And there was two more at Dover way. And the idea was, we sailed over and sunk the ships in the entrance of Dunkirk Harbour to render the harbour useless to the enemy.
Who was in charge of it? SS Holland?
SS Holland, well, I can't remember the captain's name now, but it was a lieutenant commander. He was RN, and there was the other officer was a lieutenant RNR. But we didn't get to know each other well because we were only together about 48 hours from the time of sailing to the time of sinking.
What kind of a crew did it have?
Well, they were mainly regulars. In fact, I think most of them were regulars, but we only went over with a skeleton crew, which was only about 15 strong.
By yourself?
Oh no, we're escorted by MTBs. There was three block ships and seven MTBs as the escort.
And were you attacked by the enemy?
Well, it was during the middle of the night, 3 o'clock, when we got into position. And it was like Guy Fawkes night. There was tracers and rockets and God knows what flying all over the place. But I got wounded, something hit the gun shield. I was a Lewis gunner, and we just had two gun positions, one each side of the bridge. And both myself and an AB by the name of Mason got wounded.
Seriously?
No, not real serious. But at the bottom half of my big toe, it seemed to have been shot off and wounded in the nose. I didn't see the end of this operation because the captain removed me and my mate onto an MTB. But when we were landed ashore at Dover to catch the hospital train, the chief in charge of the cop party, as they called it, he said he'd be pleased to know that it was a success. So they obviously sunk the block ships where they wanted to sink them.
The cock party being the party that let the water into the ship?
No, the cock party was in charge of the cot that you were laid in when they hoisted you ashore. They had an explosive charge in the bottom of the ship, and there was a petty officer LTO, which is a leading torpedo man, and he was in charge of setting this charge off when the captain told him. And then that just used to blow the bottom of the ship out, and the crew then had, you know, take to the MTBs to get back home.
Did you see anything of the evacuation from Dunkirk?
No, I didn't see anything at all, really, because by the time we got over there, you know, we wanted to get in the zone when it was dark, so with a bit of luck, nobody would see us. And I think we were after the harbour where more or less vast majority of the evacuation, I think, was done from the beaches further up. There was a few ships around, but I wouldn't know who they were or what they were.
Now, later on in 1940, in October, you were a Lewis gunner at Southend, I think. Was that during the Blitz?
It was a party called AA Guard. and there'd been myself as a leading seaman and four Lewis gunners. And we used to wait for a convoy going down south, mainly small coasters. And then we used to take the Lewis guns on board, rig them up each side of the bridge, and you'd go through convoy through the Dover Straits. And there was also vessels that used to tow barrage balloons to try and stop the enemy dive bombing the ships. But that was also a job that was done mainly during the middle of the night to try and get out to the danger zone, you know, as soon as possible. Because one of the, well, the fearful things about that trip was the Germans by this time had got the coast and they had, I think there were 11-inch guns at least. And if they picked up the convoy, they always used to open fire. Sometimes you were lucky, sometimes you'd got through the danger zone. Or sometimes you just got into it. So it was a case of, you know, keeping your fingers crossed.
Did you actually hit any enemy aircraft, or was it just a question of keeping them up?
Well, I can't honestly say I ever hit one. I might have frightened a couple, but never got a hit, never brought one down. But I don't think many guns did.
What were the kind of losses like in the convoys that you observed?
Well, we were lucky if we didn't lose a couple by the time we got down to the south coast. Once we got down to the south coast, like Southampton or somewhere like that, we'd disembark, because the ships would very likely be going on Land's End way. And we lived in a mansion house at Totten, outside Southampton. And there we'd stay until we waited for the next convoy going back up through the channel. And then we'd disembark at Southend. So you'd be running from Southend to the coast and back up to Southend when the convoys were ready to go.
How frightening was that work?
Well, it was a bit airy when these damn big guns were... shells were splashing all around you. And they even produced one gun. They had fired shells that landed 10 miles inland at Dover.
So the worst section of the voyage was Dover-Folkestone area?
Was the Dover Straits, yes, that's right, because the guns, they could, they could reach you easy. That's why they always planned to go in through the dark, hoping that they hadn't seen you.
Did you have any trouble from E-boats?
There was a few E-boat attacks, but mind you, we had our destroyers. Destroyers were escorting us. I don't think they got many.
Now, can we go on to your volunteering for Special Service? Can you tell me what you recollect about that? I think this was 1942.
Yes, in 42 I was at Whale Island. I'd just completed a gunnery course. And over the tannoy there was a broadcast saying volunteers are requested for Special Service must be reasonable swimmers. I volunteered and I was sent over to HMS Dolphin, where I was interviewed. I had to see Commander Sladen, who turned out to be the training officer behind the Special Service party. Nobody told you what it was going to be. Chariots weren't mentioned. In fact, you didn't know what you'd volunteered for a long time, until the machine eventually came.
But what had put it in your mind to volunteer for it?
Well, I don't know. It's things you do, isn't it?
Boredom?
Oh, not boredom, no. I thought it sounded interesting. I mean, you know, some people volunteer. They say one volunteer is better than 10 press men. Anyhow, Commander Sladen accepted me, and then we started to train. Now, the first test, they used to have escape tanks for the submariners to train for escaping from submarines. And you got into this little chamber, and then you came out into the main tank, which was about 15 foot deep. And that was the initial test. Once you got that, then they more or less thought you were fairly, you know, all right underwater. And then from there you progressed to doing a certain amount of helmet diving, which was the old pump in those days. In fact, that was the only diving we had before the war, was the pump diving. And the other, the oxygen diving, was used by submariners to escape from submarines, which eventually was used by chariots on their job, because we didn't have any other, you know, kind of diving apparatus in those days. From helmet diving, then we carried on doing a lot of oxygen diving in a place called Halsey Island, where they had about 30 foot of water, and they put a bench down on the bottom of the lock with lots of tools and wire and stuff like that, that you used to go down there and amuse yourself by cutting and getting used to being underwater. Then the big test came was at C.B. Gorman's. Now, C.B. Gorman's, they had a diving tank there, which you could stand in it and put your hand would be out of water. There'd be an instructor, he'd be sat in the tank but outside the water level with the communications, and then they used to fasten a big lid, and they had means of putting pressure on into the tank to simulate diving at 60 feet. Well, oxygen was only safe to what they called the first atmosphere, which was 33 and a third feet, if I remember rightly. But you had to do this half an hour at 60 feet before, you know, you did accept you for what the job was going to be, which still at the time we didn't know. Anyhow, the first lot that went up there, it was a bit scary, because there was about eight of us, and six went unconscious within about 10 minutes of being in the tank. They had a big table outside, and this chap who was in the tank with you, he'd be saying to the people up top, "Diver giving himself more oxygen, diver giving himself more oxygen, diver unconscious." And then they'd open the lid, lower this table down, which you had a rig bolt on the back of your harness, hoist you out. Professor Haldane, he was the big professor of diving in those days at C.B. Gorman's, and he used to look at you for a while. And then someone would take you away on a stretcher to the sick bay, which was most embarrassing, because this place was full of young ladies all making diving equipment. Then you'd likely have dinner with them, and they'd be saying, "Thought you sailors were supposed to be tough. All they kept seeing was bodies coming out." Anyhow, I passed after the third attempt. Some of them passed first time, some of them second. Well, there wasn't many that passed first time. Anyhow, once you had that test over, then that was the end of that, and the training down south. And then we went up north to a place called Loch Erisort, which wasn't far from Stornoway. Then came this log of what I describe as a log of wood. It had a pump, two pumps that you could pump water in, two compartments. It had a hydroplane, a rudder that you could dive with, but it was towed by a dinghy, by our training officer in those days, who was Lieutenant Commander fell. Very nice chap. And then he'd tell you to dive. Well, this thing was useless. I mean, one minute you'd be on the surface, the next minute you'd be bouncing on the bottom. But that was just still a bit more diving training, and then eventually the chariot came. But of course, by the time we'd seen this log of wood, we had a fair idea what the job was. And then, of course, we started chariot training in earnest.
Could you pull out at any time of the training if you wanted to?
Oh, I suppose so, yes.
Did anybody do that?
I don't remember anybody doing it. Some were sent out because they suffered with claustrophobia, you know, never got used to being underwater. I don't remember anybody bailing out.
So can you describe the actual chariot training itself in as much detail as you can recollect, please?
Well, chariot training, we were on a ship called the first one was Cyclops, the next one was the Titania, which we used to practice attacks on the ship. These were all, to start with, we used to do day running. Now, Commander Sladen, who was our officer in charge of the whole affair, he produced and designed what you call a Sladen suit, which you got in through the centre. And then you could button up the centre to make it watertight. And then you had these oxygen bottles strapped on your back. Well, to start your diving, first of all, you'd get on the machine, which was already in the water. And the first thing to do then would be to vent your diving suit. Otherwise, it would be, you'd be like a blown-up balloon. So you used to vent it by, you know, letting air escape out the cuffs. And you also had a vent on the top of the head. And once you'd vented your suit, which meant to say, then you was... your body had got, in the suit, had got diving trim. You hadn't got too much air in the suit. And then the next job was to get diving trim on the machine. Now, the first machine, the Mark One, it was fitted with a tank forward, a tank aft, and a little emergency diving tank in the centre. So, by pumping water in forward and pumping water in aft, then you eventually settle so your head was just clear of water. And that was what you call getting diving trim. You used to do this alongside the ship before you ever set off. And then away you'd go, practicing diving runs, tacking the ship. And this went on endlessly. This was quite a few crews, and, you know, they had to sort out who was going to go on the first jobs and things like that.
How much keenness was there to get into action?
Oh, they're all keen. Oh, yes. They're all keen, but some were better than others, I suppose. But,
Which part of the training... was there any part of the training which you didn't like?
Well, if anything, the damn diving. I mean, because this oxygen was funny stuff. I've seen people pass out on the surface with oxygen poisoning. They used to give it a nickname called Oxygen Pete. You see a chap, you know, sat there quite happy, and then the next thing is floating away. Because it was, as I say, funny stuff. But I don't know about any of the other charities, but I never used to dive until I really had to. Because in the middle of the night, you could do most of your attack on the surface. And you had a two-way cock that you could switch to fresh air. So until it was really necessary to dive, there was no need to, you know, push your luck too far with oxygen when you didn't have to.
Were there any serious accidents which you remember in the training?
In the training, oh yes, we did lose. We lost one chap in Aussie Island in the early stages, unfortunately, his lifeline had come undone, and he never surfaced. I think they had to get helmet divers, and they found him a long time afterwards. And then we had another poor chap, I think he came from South Africa, Sub-Lieutenant Grogan. He was doing a dummy attack on HMS Howe, a battleship, and he caught his head against the bilge keel, crushed it. We used to have some near misses, get chaps, you know, who'd floated off the machine, who'd maybe got a bit of oxygen poisoning, but luckily, in most of the training runs, you were secured with a lanyard from one chap to the other.
From your elbow?
Yeah, so that if one bloke was in any difficulties and suddenly started getting oxygen poisoning or floating away, the other bloke would know about it and then could bring him to the surface. That's happened quite a few times.
Did the accidents affect the morale of the others?
No, it just made you, you know, be a bit more aware of your diving.
So I interrupted your account of the training, if you can pick it up from where I interrupted you, please.
Well, we eventually left Loch Erisault and went to a place called Loch U, I think it was, which was 30 miles south of Cape Wrath. And they had nets put up there. The battleship Howe came up there and stayed with us for a while so everybody could do, you know, training runs on the actual battleship. So Titania was only a small thing and, you know, about 10 foot down and you're under the bottom of the ship. But the Howe was a different kettle of fish. So it was all night work by this time. You'd finished day running.